tonight on Arena. Stellan Skarsgård and Diego Luna tell us about season 2 of Andor, and Warfare, The Penguin Lessons and Verdigris are the movies up for review. RTE 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. And in our film reviews this evening, War in Iraq, The Argentinian Coup with Added Penguin, and An Irish Story of an Unlikely Friendship. In The Penguin Lesson, Steve Coogan stars as Tom Michel, I believe he calls himself, even though it looks very like Mitchell, a real-life British teacher working in Argentina just at the start of that country's brutal, dirty war. Tom forms an unlikely bond with a rescue penguin who turns out to be one of life's great listeners. Festival favourite, Verdigris, is the debut feature film from Irish writer and director Patricia Kelly. It tells the story of a friendship between two women, one a middle-aged census enumerator returning to work to escape the pain of her dysfunctional marriage, the other a teenage sex worker. But first to Warfare, from co-writers and directors Alex Garland and Ray Mendoza. Mendoza was military consultant on last year's Civil War, which Alex Garland spoke to us about here on the programme, a film and an interview I still remember very well, I must say. Warfare, however, is not speculative fiction in the way that Civil War is. This is a real life story about an incident involving a troop of US Navy SEALs at a house in Ramadi in Iraq in 2006, an event that Mendoza himself was present for. Justin McGregor and Gemma Cray are our reviewers on this Thursday evening. 90 minutes this Warfare film is, from Mendoza and Garland. White knuckle ride for 90 minutes, I would say, Justin.
It's funny. It's fascinating because it starts with kind of the mundane routine of waiting. And they don't know if they've broken into this house, and they don't know if people know that they're there. And the slow reveal is they do know, and the insurgents start to surround it. Suddenly a grenade comes in through the window. And from that moment on, it's absolutely unbelievable. You really feel like you're in this house, the claustrophobia of it. You know, you never really see the people shooting at them. There's just bullets coming in and shadows moving by covered windows. And it is white knuckle. But it's also, it's terrifying. Like, you really... And the soldiers themselves, they're terrified. There's one point where the captain says, "I can't lead them anymore." Like, he's too shell-shocked just from this 90 minutes.
They're waiting for help to come from...
And waiting for help to come. And they have to lie to eventually get rescued. They have to pretend that they're command and give an order to, for the Bradleys to come and take them out. But it's so intense, but not in like a blockbuster Hollywood way, in this really kind of intimate, horrifying way.
And this is a true life story that Mendoza himself was, he was there for this real life event. I think the thing at the top talks about told from memory. Yeah. So it is a real life event, but it's acknowledging that it's the way he remembers it.
So Alex Garland, again, is a very accomplished writer and filmmaker and has done really big productions and is quite sort of political, but apolitical, like in his statement, in his projects that he does. And he, Raymond Doza, was the military consultant on his last project, Civil War. And Alex just walked up to him and said, is there a story that you want to tell? And Ray did. This was, again, a real event that happened to him and his crew in 2006. It's his memory, but his memory is fragmented because he had suffered from a really bad concussion. So, and again, like, if you see Will Poulter's character, Eric as well, when the IED goes off, like, everyone's blown apart. Like, they watch people being blown apart. There's limbs thrown everywhere. Like, it's so visceral. But there's no rushing it. Like, there essentially is no plot. You're spending time with them. And I think that's, you're saying about the reactions, I think that's one of the things that are so unnerving, is because it isn't macho people fighting.
There's a real sense of that we're watching things happening in real time. It has that feel of it. And it's a real... Ensemble cast. You've both mentioned. What's his name?
Will Coulter.
Will Coulter. Thank you very much. Poulter. I beg your pardon. Aaron McKenzie is in there. Cosmo Jarvis. There's a whole bundle of them, and it's these blokes inside this house. Let's have a. Sorry. Go ahead, Gemma.
Oh yeah, I was going to say, but basically all the characters that are there, it's their memories.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Ray Mendoza went and interviewed every single one of them because he had a concussion. Because Will had a concussion.
Yeah. So told
from
memory.
Fragments. So they they researched it, investigated it, and it's so true from everyone.
Let's have a listen. Now, this is just a little section from the trailer, but and you'll hear several of the voices of the... Because it's an ensemble piece. There's no other way to describe
it. There's no hero.
There's no one big leader or anything like that. You get a sense of the tension from this clip.
Redman 08 is profane. We're seeing activity converging to your north and south.
This is Frogman 6, Romeo. We need to evac at our last known position.
We have severely wounded.
Who's the severely wounded?
It's not you.
It's me.
Who is it?
No, it's not you.
Who is it?
Stop you one word, Contact 2.
You coming to you or you coming to us?
Damn right.
We'll let you know when we're inbound.
Let's move!
Here's the plan.
DA 5 minutes, over.
The scouts are gonna lead us out, and I'm bringing up the rear.
Pop smoke.
Smoke out.
We are all coming back to this.
And there, a clip from the trailer to Warfare, which we're speaking about this evening as part of our film reviews. And Justin, do we get any sense of outside the building? You know, we get certainly some views of those who are going to attack the building, but of the ordinary people on the streets, the ordinary Ramadians or whatever one calls a person from Ramadi.
It starts with us seeing them because they're monitoring the comings and going from this kasbah, this cafe, and they're trying to see, you know, if terrorists are there. So we see them kind of coming and going. And then there's this moment when all the civilians just start to pack up and go, and they know they've been spotted, you know, and that something is afoot, and then it's not long after the grenade kind of comes through the window. So, but it's really interesting that they, like, even at the end, you know, even at the end when they're being evacuated and they're finally gone, all these bodies just step out of alleyways and step in front, you rise up from behind walls. We'd never really seen them. They've just been shadows and shots and quick kind of movement. So it's very much told of, like, this is what warfare is like when you're inside it. Apolitically, is kind of, as Gemma was saying.
Yeah, because with a title like Warfare, you could be forgiven for thinking, all right, I'm going to a buddy-buddy movie here and there's going to be the usual things in a war movie. It's not that movie, I don't think, Gemma. Give me your summary in it and stars, please.
Oh, 4, just, it's an amazing, 4.5. It was just such an intense film. I will never watch it again. ever.
But very intense and enjoyable for the one watch that you're going to give it. And you, Justin?
Oh yeah, no, an easy 4 stars. So immersive and so, it's funny, at the one hand, it's what Hollywood does really well, but it doesn't use any of those Hollywood, you know, like what Gemma's saying about the limbs, they're just there. And the fact they're not, you know, focused on makes it all the more horrifying that they're there. It's
all amazing. Right, so a solid 4 from you. Warfare, the title of our first film this evening. War is part of our second film, The Penguin Lessons. Steve Coogan as a British teacher, Tom Michel, who befriends a penguin. And it's important to note now, Gemma, I suppose we get the war bit in here. We're in Argentina in 1979, and it's based on a memoir by the real life Tom Michel. What kind of Argentina are we in, and what kind of man are we with?
Yeah, so it's a very fascist place. There's the people on the ground are being monitored at all times. There's such a divide between the rich and poor. Tom is. He's there, but he decides he's apolitical. This film is not apolitical, but he decides he's apathetic. He's there just to get paid well because he's working in this very privileged boys' school. He doesn't really want to get involved in what's happening, but he can kind of see, you know, the resistance in the guy that works in the local fish shop. Yeah. He observes this, but he's very much so as somebody who doesn't want to get involved because he's tired. He comes in with this very exhausted energy. He just wants to have an easy life, have a few drinks, go dancing, meet some women. But all of that is ruined when he tries to meet a woman and instead ends up with this penguin that he accidentally rescues. And
which sounds like, you know, as if we're going to go into some kind of surreal world. And there is something surreal about the constant presence of the penguin who's watching and listening. We are told to everything that's been said. How does that kind of absurdity fit in with the very gritty reality of what was the dirty war in Argentina?
Well, I think it comes across as two films. I mean, I think as the memoir, I think, you know, you can have chapters that maybe go into a local history and are a bit darker. But in a film, it creates a bit of a tonal unbalance. Mm. And definitely there's a shift in the middle. I mean, the fascism is always there, but you never quite know where the film is going to go. If it's going to go to, you know, a Dead Poets Society with a penguin, or if it's going to go into, you know, these amazing films Argentinian filmmakers make about the disappeared. And it kind of tries to a bit do both and wrap them both up in its climax in a way that I think isn't quite satisfying. So it's interesting to see the marketing of the film, because they're playing like, oh, Steve Coogan and the Penguin, ha ha ha, and it is not ha
it's
ha
not,
ha.
It's not a funny ha ha movie at all. And you get a sense of that Dead Poets Society side to the film, and indeed the kind of quirky comedy that a penguin on set is always going to bring in this clip that I'm about to play. Steve Coogan as Tom, bringing his penguin friend, who he has called Juan Salvador, into the classroom for the first time and introducing him to his boys.
¿Qué?
Now, I must go down to the sea again, to the lonely sea and sky, and all I ask is a tall ship, a star to steer her by. What does John Masefield mean by that? Igor.
Sir, you have a pinguino on your desk?
English, please. It's a penguin, and his name is Juan Salvador.
Why do you have a penguin on your desk?
To get you all to pay attention, and I think it's worked. Yes, Walter.
But where you get the penguin from, sir?
I found him. And let's just keep this between ourselves for the time being. If anyone finds out, he'll be confiscated. Look, I'll make you a deal. If you spend the rest of this lesson helping me figure out what this poem actually means, then I'll let you all feed him some fish at lunchtime. Deal? Well, go on, nod your heads. Juan Salvador, deal? Yes, yes, he's okay with that. All right, so concentration from now on, please.
Yeah, I can't let it go. If anyone finds out, he'll be confiscated. That means that the boy who finds out will be confiscated. So let us do nothing about that and push it to one side. My little moment of umbrella or anorak, I should say. Juan Salvador, my Spanish speaking consultants tell me, Salvador means savior. No. So is this penguin a savior for the Steve Coogan character, which is what I would suspect? Or how do we get into, because you say it's apolitical, but it does in the latter half. It doesn't go away. So it's not apolitical. Yeah. The film is not apolitical, but he's apolitical. But he gets pulled in, I think, eventually, doesn't he?
There's a bunch of different threads, I think, that don't quite line up. The number one, he's dealing with a personal grief, and that's sort of why he is apolitical. Like, we do learn this as it goes on. It's sort of obvious there's something off with him, but that's why he's so shut down. There's that thread. There's the thread of him teaching the boys and wanting to teach the boys and educate them, and that politics seeps into the classroom, and one of the boys is being bullied because of his political leanings. Then there's another thread, and it's the granddaughter of the cleaner, Sophia. She's an activist, and she's trying to kind of appeal to his side, and really the penguin acts as a catalyst to get him involved in all those worlds, because, you know, he starts off so selfish, and everyone loves the penguin, so then they're interacting with him in a way, and then he just opens up.
Of course he does. He would have to. And Justin, touching on that, just to stay with you for a moment, Gemma, Justin touching on that idea of it wants both things. It wants the political side as well. Is it a bit clunky when suddenly we're shifting into this almost search for the disappeared feel towards the end of the film?
Yeah, it skirts. There's a real darkness, and I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but there's a real difficult thing that happens, and it just wraps up.
Too neat.
And in a way, like, I mean, one of the elements sort of wraps up in a way that just, there's, it's tackling it, but it doesn't deal with the authenticity of it. It's almost like all these things are sort of touched upon but aren't interwoven or don't interact with one another. And I think that's why it's unsatisfying. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it is enjoyable and it does.
Yeah, and I mean, deliver. It has Coogan. Yeah. It just seems to be going from strength to strength on screen. And we should say Jonathan Pryce is in here as well as the headmaster.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
Timothy Buckle, is that his name?
Yes, headmaster
like
Buckle.
From an Enid Blyton novel.
Yeah, and he has a great, his scene, everyone sort of talks to the penguin, but his scene with the penguin in particular is just really, really great. Only Jonathan Pryce could pull off this kind of monologue to a penguin and move you and be sort of a wonderful
okay.
little moment.
Stars from you, Justin?
Yeah, at the end credits, they show home movies of the mothers of the disappeared, and you realize that it stopped short of really going somewhere. And you realize when you see that, you kind of realize what the film was. And I gave it 2.5 stars.
And what are you saying, Gemma?
It is enjoyable as a film. It just like that. I think at the moment as well, the themes are just so close to home. It's slightly harder to watch as well. So I would say 3.
Three from you. Okay, that's The Penguin Lessons, second film this evening. Moving on then to our third and final film from writer and director Patricia Kelly. Her first feature, in fact. We spoke to her, I think, around this time last year about this very film. Verdigris, debut feature from Patricia Kelly, draws Gemma on Patricia's own experience of working as a census enumerator. And Marion, who is the character here, is returning to work and in a very difficult marriage, which is kind of there in the background, and you're not expecting it from this quiet couple that we meet at the beginning.
Yeah, so again, she's just retired from a legal profession. She's figuring out as well. It's like one of those times where that relationship that she's hoping to have with her husband isn't quite there. We get hints of it in the beginning, but he's quite controlling with money as well. So she's quiet about this job. That's why she goes into inner city Dublin because it's far away from her leafy green South Dublin suburbs. So she doesn't necessarily want her husband involved in this area because she, again, her life is so quiet. He doesn't talk to her. She has photos of all her friends, but the holidays she goes on are the ones that he wants to go on. Like, her world is really
shut
down.
Yeah, it's a classic type of coercive control, and it does build as the film draws on. And with Geraldine McAlinden as Marion and Michael James Ford as Nigel, the husband. But the real relationship at the heart of this film is between Geraldine McAlinden's character and a young woman she meets, because she can't get anybody to fill in a census, that just slammed the door in her face. This young woman called Jewel, played by Maya O'Shea, Justin.
Yeah, no, it's that friendship is the heart of the film, and it's the best part of the film. It's the strongest part of the film. Yeah. She kind of recruits Jewel to help her get people to fill out the census forms. So she agrees to give her, I think she gets €8 a census form, and she'll give 3 to Jewel if she'll just sort of knock on the door and be like, she's all right, you know, and sort of get it filled out. And it works. And of course, as they're walking the streets, they're talking, and they begin to form a bond. And we find out there's backstory as to why Marion might be interested in being this kind of mother figure to Jewel.
Let's have a listen to the moment that the two of them meet, and Jewel is fairly forthright in how she tells Marion what she's doing wrong as she goes around the various houses trying to get people to fill in census forms.
Jewel, participation in the 2022 census is mandatory, not voluntary. It means you have to do it.
I know what mandatory means, and voluntary. I've heard you, giving your speech all around the building. Everywhere I go, there you are, wobbling your lardy arse.
Well, you get a parent or a guardian to fill out this form properly, and you won't ever have to see my lardy arse again.
There you go, Geraldine McAlinden as Marion and Maya O'Shea as Jewel. I have to say, the two of them, I remember this film from a year ago, and the relationship that builds between the two of them and the way they interact with each other and how their stories open up to us, the viewer, I find quite extraordinary, Gemma.
It's very beautiful. I think that's the heart of that, the relationship, the back, like how both of them are going through such separate traumas and again would have very specific ideas about how each one exists, but like that, when they kind of open up and become part of each other's worlds, there's a real healing. But the chemistry between them, the warmth, and how it flitters and how it bounces back and forth, and how, you know, walls come up and you know, it's just so heartbreaking, Marion's character and the things that she's experienced in her past. And there's just one of the most beautiful monologues I've heard of Geraldine McLendon performing. Just, it's so raw. I bawled my eyes out the first time I watched
it.
It's
a very, very moving film. And Maya O'Shea, I think this is it's a debut feature from Patricia Kelly, and I think this is a very early performance in the career of Maya O'Shea. She's a real star on screen.
Yeah, no, she's fantastic. I mean, this chemistry between the two of them. And yeah, considering one has, you know, quite a substantive CV now and the other had a very thin CV, they're equal matches, absolutely. And it really is what gives it its strength. You know, you believe the relationship and it's a real friendship. They don't just become friends and stay friends. They have little fights and they have big fights and small fights, and then they make up as friends do and kind of continue on. And it's all that works really, really well.
Yeah,
well,
there's nothing obvious in the way the plot moves and in the way the relationship builds and falls apart and builds again. Stars from you for Fair Degree. Gemma?
4. The reason I'm so excited about this film is because, like, Patricia made this with a credit union loan and an Indiegogo campaign. This was just a labour of passion. And it's so exciting to see something get this far that has come from such humble roots. So I just adored it.
All right. And what are you saying, Justin?
Yeah, no, I 4 stars. Great acting is great acting. You know, a bit more nuance maybe in some of the other storylines would have just maybe got it to a 5. But it's excellent. It's excellent.
It's excellent. And a solid 4 from both of you then for Verdigris, which is in selected cinemas. Gemma Cray and Justin McGregor speaking to us about Verdigris and indeed Warfare and The Penguin Lessons. General release for them tomorrow. And as I say, selected cinemas for Verdigris. The Disney Plus series Andor is unique in the Star Wars universe. There is no magic. There are no Jedi Knights, no lightsabers. The Force is strong in precisely nobody. Some, in fact, have described Andor as Ken Loach in a galaxy far, far away. And what emerges from this earthy approach is a critically acclaimed spy thriller which depicts authoritarianism and resistance in an entirely human way. Series stars Mexican actor Diego Luna as Cassian Andor, one of the fabled rebel spies who will go on to steal the plans for the Death Star warship, setting in motion the events of the first ever Star Wars film, A New Hope. Across its 2 seasons, this prequel series brings us into Cassian's life up to the events of the film Rogue One, and it is his journey from petty thief to revolutionary leader that we are following. The series is the brainchild of writer and director Tony Gilroy, and among its stars are Irish actors Denise Goff, Genevieve O'Reilly and Fiona Shaw. But as we shall hear, Gilroy is a keen reader of revolutionary history, and the Irish influence extends far beyond just the casting. Sinead Egan spoke to Tony Gilroy, along with stars Diego Luna, Stellan Skarsgård, who plays rebel mastermind Luthen Rael, and Adria Arjona, who plays Bix Kaleen, Cassian's love and fellow traumatised resistance fighter. Before we hear from the stars of Andor, let's listen to a scene from the very start of season 2. Diego Luna, as Cassian Andor, is on a mission to steal the Imperial TIE TIE fighter and is posing as a test pilot, but his undercover rebel contact at the Imperial Test Centre is in need of reassurance.
If I die tonight, was it worth it? You've done this before. You must have thought about it.
This makes it worth it. This. Right now. Being with you, being here at the moment you step into the circle. Look at me. You made this decision long ago. The Empire cannot win. You'll never feel right unless you're doing what you can to stop them. You're coming home to yourself. You've become more than your fear. Let that protect you.
Diego Luna, Adria Arjona, welcome to Arena.
Thank you so much.
Diego, Andor is still very much in a state of transformation when we meet him at the start of season 2. Or is it that he's becoming more open to the potential that he knows he has inside himself to be a big leader?
I don't think he knows that. I don't think he actually believes in that. I think he believes or starts to believe in the need for change, you know, and it's through the process of this second season that he finds out what he's capable of. But we're gonna see him fighting against that, you know, because I'm sure it's quite scary to find out you have the potential to be a leader, you know, because then a lot is expected from you. And this guy, I think, starts because he had an awakening through season one. But now he has to understand what he can bring to the table and how important it is for his community that he gets involved.
Adria, Bix has such a tough road in this television program. She really shows how traumatizing conflict is, especially where women are concerned. Where is she at the start when we meet her again?
You know, Bix, when we leave her in season one, she's in such a dark place. And you know, when season two starts, sort of a year has gone through, and a year is not enough to sort of get over all that trauma from Dr. Gorst. And, you know, she's trying when we first meet her, and Bix tries a lot this season, and she leans on people, which I think is very rare for her. And I think what saves her and sort of in her journey, what saves her is kind of community and finding a home in Cassian and leaning in Cassian or on Cassian, and understanding sometimes that hiding things and is not going to take you anywhere, and sometimes reaching out for help sort of is the only choice. You know, I think Bix is someone that just kind of wants to power through things, and I don't think she's someone that sits down and talks about her emotions very well.
No, not at all.
She does not feel comfortable with that. She's just like, I have to fight through it. Give me something to do so I can get over this. And you know, she'll go through various things until she realizes that the only one that has, you know, that power is herself. And it's hard. It's a lot harder said than done, I think. So, yeah, she has a very beautiful journey this season, and it was a joy to, you know, to play her, and it was a joy to sort of build this beautiful relationship, sort of kind of paved the way for in season one.
To both of you, watching season two, it's striking that this drama is set in a galaxy far, far away, but it has so much to say about the world that we live in now.
Well, yes, and I think that is the strength of science fiction, and it's been something that that Star Wars has done over the years, you know, the interesting part and sad at the same time is that probably it's going to be relevant also in 20 years, you know, because we repeat ourselves, you know. We were not predicting the future when we were planning this second season. In fact, we were talking about the past, you know. Our reference are like the history we know, and that's what we bring to the table. But then, yes, you come out and you go like, damn, this sounds very pertinent today, and that's because we tend to, to repeat ourselves and to not to get the lesson right, which is I guess it's humanity.
You told me he'd stay away from Skaldon. He's been pestering him since he arrived.
I know.
I warned you from the start.
I just can't believe it. I've known him my whole life.
People fail. That's our curse. What would have happened if I wasn't here? Would you have told me?
I'm meeting him next week. Yes, yes, I would have told you. I'll warn him off. I'll find what it takes. I'll get a number.
You know the number. We'd be vulnerable forever. You need to be protected.
I'm not sure what you're saying.
How nice for you.
Tony Gilroy, welcome to Arena. Stellan Skarsgård, welcome back to Arena. Tony, if I could start with you. If the first season was the education of Cassian Andor, how would you characterise the second season? What is Andor's state of mind now?
He's committed
to the revolution. He's been out for a year. I'm hoping you can feel all the things that he's been doing and working for Luthen. He's become more of a leader. And the second season is, you know, if there was a giant wave in the distance that looked like it was rising, it's coming now. It's crashing over everyone. And everything has become intensified for all of the characters. Romance, their loyalties, their betrayals. It really is the culmination of what happens when history comes knocking on your door.
Yeah, yeah. Stellan, Tony has said elsewhere that the word that they kept in mind during this production of season two was pilgrim. For you, how did that apply to Luthen?
Pilgrim, that was the working title for the entire show, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up. I always forget about that. It was very apt title. No, I know, but go ahead. That's cool. A cool question. I mean, you're always searching for a fake title because you need one for secrecy, you know? This one was just really apt. It just really fit. We're like, oh, yeah, let's have that. And they are all pilgrims, aren't they? Everybody here is on that sort of a journey and the tribulations that come with pilgrimage in a way. So it I see where you're going. I'll be using that next week. Yes.
My pleasure. So Stellan, I suppose Luthen is still very much so the driving force. He's pushing this rebellion in Andor, and Luthen himself is very singular in his own politics when it comes to what he has to sacrifice.
Yeah, he's very singular. It's and he doesn't care about what he has to sacrifice. He doesn't care about what anybody else has to sacrifice. He is fully convinced that his revolution is necessary. The problem with revolutions is that there's not only one revolution. There's thousands of revolutions going on the same time, which means that each person has his own revolution, and they eventually will collide. But I think that he's not immoral in his sort of brutality, in his pragmatic brutality. He thinks that it will be better for everybody if this person dies instead of, for instance, revealing some secrets and letting more people die. But of course, it's harsh.
No longer any ground beneath my feet. What is my sacrifice? I'm condemned to use the tools of my enemy to defeat them. I burn my decency for someone else's future. I burn my life to make a sunrise that I know I'll never see. Now the ego that started this fight will never have a mirror or an audience or the light of gratitude. So what do I sacrifice? Everything!
Tony, the character studies that we get in both series of Andor are on both sides of this conflict so detailed, because we see deep into the Empire, we see the mechanics of it and the complex politics of it, but we also see the very ordinary human failings of the people who are making these catastrophic decisions. Why was it important for you to tell the story in this way?
I kind of been doing that my whole, I mean, that's really, you find out what you really think when you go out to sell things and when you end up talking about them after the fact. It's not an agenda that I start with. I mean, I've never been able to write any character without inhabiting them, without feeling for them. I mean, this is an empathy business. And on an institutional level, if you're talking about something like the ISB or the Empire or the CIA, whatever it is, it's my belief and it's my dramatic starting point that human behavior sort of rusts out any machinery that humans put in front of it. You know, nothing really works the way it's supposed to work.
Yes. I used the Imperial Emergency Act in the wake of Aldani to gather data across multiple sectors without official sanction, but that is the wrong question. I'd like to know if anyone here believes the rebellion plans its actions around the artificially constructed boundaries of our sectors.
Major Partagaz created those sectors.
As organizing principles, not personal playthings, do you really think the rebels care about the lines we draw on maps?
You think the relevance of my work has been supplanted?
Systems either change or die, sir.
And in the end, ideologues are worrying about career. They're worrying about their insecurities. They're worrying about their parking place. They're worried about who's getting ahead of them. They're worried about, you know, I'm really interested in those details are much more illuminating than someone just waving a flag.
And Stellan, when you were building the character of Luthen, why did you think he became so ruthless? How did you get him to that point in your own head?
When I started out, Tony just had a light drawing of what was going to happen to Luthen. Some of it was good, some of it was not that good because it was very loose. So I knew about what he wanted to do with him. But what was important was what I had to play was not what had happened to him, because that comes later. What I had to play was where he was now. And I understood I had to play this man that is more or less obsessed by his goal. And I had to play this strange relationship with Clea. She's played by Elizabeth Dulau in a wonderful way. She is totally sort of owns the scenes that she's in without doing much.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
Luthen becomes like a little rag sort of fluttering around her. I didn't know exactly what had happened, but something really interesting had happened and created that relationship.
And Tony, Irish audiences watching this and watching last season, rightly or wrongly, because of the Empire, how it treats small planets, I mean, Ferrix in season one, you know, we'll see parallels with our own history from the depiction of running battles and even down to this very Republican-looking funeral at the end of season one.
Well, I mean, specifically for the funeral, I mean, yeah, it's a second-line funeral. It's a Troubles funeral. Yeah, I mean, of course. And funerals throughout history have been flashpoints for Trouble. There just happens to be more video of Northern Ireland than any place else.
The Empire is a disease that thrives in darkness. It is never more alive than when we sleep. It's easy for the dead to tell you to fight. And maybe it's true, maybe fighting's useless. Perhaps it's too late. But I'll tell you this. If I could do it again, I'd wake up early and be fighting these bastards from the start. Fight the Empire!
Yeah, I mean, I am fascinated and have been fascinated by revolution and insurrection and oppression for years. I mean, I've been reading all about it. I know a lot about the Troubles. I know a lot about the Russian Revolution and the Haitian Revolution and Zapata. Because I've been given such a huge opportunity, 1,500 pages and all this money and all these amazing people to tell a story about revolution, I feel somewhat beholden to try to do the biggest, best composite version of it that I can. So I'm drawing on everything. But yes, absolutely. I've seen a lot of videos. We watched a lot of videos of Trouble's funerals, for sure.
Yeah. And staying on the Irish theme, you know, watching it as an Irish woman, really heartening to see so many great Irish actresses in it. Denise Gough, Fiona Shaw, Genevieve O'Reilly, who is Irish, as we know, and Australian. And Keelan Dunn pops up at the end. What was it about these performers that made them such a good fit for the show?
You know what, man? We used 400 speaking parts on this show.
Wow.
400. Nina Gould and Martin Ware, who cast it, I don't think we had any idea that we were going to go that far. It has been a bouquet. And, you know, as an American, I'm liberated from any accent prejudice. I'm exempt from worrying that someone was on EastEnders for too long. I come in a blank slate, so everybody just came in with their talent. We made a decision early on that as long as people were understandable to an American ear, and we didn't have to put subtitles on, they could hang on to their homeland accent. We didn't put anybody in RP. We made a really big decision, so we could really cast all over the place. So We were an equal opportunity employer all the way through.
Well, Tony Gilroy and Stellan Skarsgård, thank you so much for talking to Arena again.
Thank you very much.
And that was actor Stellan Skarsgård and showrunner of Andor Tony Gilroy speaking there with Sinead Egan. The first three episodes of the second and final season of Andor will be available on Disney Plus from Tuesday of next week, April 22nd. Donegal musician Declan McLafferty, known by his solo moniker Ramper, released his debut album Loner last month. It was named RTE Radio 1's Album of the Week and tipped by the Irish Independent as one to watch in 2025. Written, performed and self-produced entirely at home during his children's nap times, Ramper drew on personal memories, forgotten traditions and the quiet times of everyday life. Ahead of his headline tour in May, delighted to be joined by Ramper in studio live this evening. Is as Donegal, is as Tír Chonail to Declan. Tátú con an Aaron Eyes hurch doing. Keiko tátú is a tá Donegal san Aaron show.
Yeah, the Donegal tá with Aaron for the record actually. Tasha Bonihan August just an doy of Vima Comfort actually freed your pandemic. Mar shin sias seal of yogum nor of ima og amwa fin dua his bon nadunuf.
So the pandemic, yeah. In fact, because many people spoke about the pandemic bringing back things, and for you it brought back your youth, it brought back those kind of a kind of old style of living.
So simple.
Old school.
It was so simple. You had what you had, you used what you had. You know, that was it. I was really, like when I was young, I thought that I was missing something. I was jealous of other people who grew up in population centres because I thought that I was the one who was missing out. And then as I got older, I realised that I got a real glimpse into the past.
Yeah.
Because I grew up around such an older cultural thing.
And Eyes then, I suppose, the title of this song that you're about to sing, it is about looking around you, yeah. And seeing. Was it a specific trip that inspired this song?
I grew up looking out the back window of the house and you could see, before they changed the bulb in the lighthouse to like the LED thing, the flash.
This is a lighthouse out on...
Oh, this is on Tory Island, so Ellen Tory. And on a bad night, you could always see it. You know, you're looking out the back window, you see the whoosh of light going past. But I never actually made it out there until I was about 24, 25, so about 12 miles from the pier in Downings, I think, by boat. And I stepped off the boat and it just felt like stepping back into my childhood, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, it stuck with me.
And that's what makes its way into and out of this song. Let's have a listen then, if you would. Eyes from Ramper.
It's like a death. Say goodbye to yourself. Now you're something else. Cigarettes on the tray. And forget all the good things you were. It all gets burned to an ash at the wake. Smoke smell hangs in the air, comes around once a year. On the wet days, you have to guess, because nobody talks. Then the wind changes north. Now you're stuck here for days on end. Like
playing hide and seek for years, but nobody comes. The old kids breaking free from younger ones, and then it happens. Get left behind, taste of pain runs from you. Different God in the sky comes around once a week on the wet days. Don't forget all them good things you learned. It all gets burned to ash at the You know it could be worse. At least they look you in the eyes as they push the knife. There's no hiding. Could at least they look you in the eyes. Shake your hand when your people die and say sorry for your loss.
Eyes, the title of that track from Rampart, and that from the debut solo album Loner, released last month, referred to on this programme as a gorgeous debut solo album and as an album with a medicinal quality to the music, was what Owen Glacken said. Aoife Barry talking about the gorgeous debut solo album. Declan McLaffrey, who is Rampart essentially, snatched, I think, between moments when your young boys were sleeping. This is when you got to write things down.
I had limited resources. I had a laptop and a mic and a really, really old interface to make the two things work together. And I suppose everything kind of slowed down once I became a dad. And every day I'd be away out with the buggy. We'd walk and walk and walk, me and Charlie. I have two boys now, Charlie and Danny. And I would be talking to them in Irish and telling them the things, and it was all kind of Rahamore and Thiel stuff, you know. It was all you're vicariously living through the eyes of your kids again, and something would come to you, and then nap time would come and you'd just quickly scurry out and get into the back hall and record it.
Yeah.
And then maybe go back in then at night time when you get them down, and Lynn, my partner's a nurse, she's often on night duty, so I had the house to myself. And that's what I did.
I August, yeah, and will you now run in Gaelic or Ascoilige?
A couple of ruddy scrief on my Gaelic, but I wore my chance go foil just rather taffed. No, sacrum
Mile.
It's in me. I have a good Irish language record in here.
Because I know the Irish language, and the importance of the Irish language is important.
Well, we have to use it.
Well, if we don't use it every now and again, it will die. Second song that you're going to sing for us, Mothers. This was, I think, written for a film that never happened, but the song did happen and the story is told in the song.
It was a bit of a... I had the song in my head for a long time, like Boots of Spanish Leather by Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
And then, you know, at the end of the song, you get the kicker where you realise the girl has left, not the fella. It's always the fella who's leaving and the girl's behind, heartbroken. But I thought that was great when the penny dropped with that. I remember that moment and I'm thinking, geez, there's something in writing songs from the female perspective, you know. Yeah. And just putting that back into the old way that I grew up and thinking about them characters.
Let's hear it then. The name of the song's gone out of my head. Mothers.
Mothers.
From Rampant.
You sent word to say that you're leaving. I heard the pen scratch on the page as you wrote. Your mother never liked me. Well, I hope that you get away clean. At the table, there's an empty seat. It's my fault in a way, I suppose. You never break down the lines or risk it all on you. And I can see what she means. All I did was there to dream beyond the horizon. Tell her the world, it's not the same now. You know that everything moves on. I dress up, I go out late to parties. Some days I don't get dressed at all. The future's mental. Stay where you are. Cause I never wanted someone on my shoulder, and I am more than the walk to the altar. And we are equals now, although we once were lovers. Make your own way. I'm
Hint of Cahalín Ar Fad on Tauron Shin. Mothers from the album Loner, from the singer Rampart, Declan McLafferty. Rampart will be at the Black Box Belfast May the 25th, Roisin Dubh Galway May the 28th, Workman's Cellar Dublin May the 29th, Kinnegar Brewery, Harashawalya, Galitzer Cannon, Angus Cuntin, Nanangal, Gerard Mesa May the 31st in Letterkenny. Rampersongs.com for full details on that. That is our lot for this Thursday evening. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy researched. John Byrne was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Buchlis was on and Sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.